just finished talking about Kay Lindsay, Elaine McNamee,
that's our first women's expedition.
Lois
yeah.
Jones.
Yeah.
And it worked out. Did you know Adam Kelly Welch over this? Did you meet with him?
Oh, Kelly Welch?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. We're good friends, yes.
He says that he championed it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, everybody did. But in fact, it was me.
Yeah. Well, the Navy had changed by then.
Yeah.
It was in the throes of changing all this.
Yeah.
Did you have any problems with the women out there of Hilo guys? Did they support it?
I think so. You know, I never met any opposition except from the likes of Paul Dalrymple and Bob Radford and so on and so forth.
But well, they blamed the Navy for not supporting all this, and it was really the Navy higher up than the local admirals at McMurdo.
Yeah.
I think they, to be quite fair, I know for sure that they said, hey, you know, we've got to change. We're doing it in the Arctic. Why aren't we? Navy.
Why not in the Antarctic?
Navy was doing it in the Arctic. Why not in the Antarctic? But of course.
Okay, well, anyway, it made a good story for many, many years afterwards of how I liberated a whole continent for women, yes. And the best comment that I ever got back was during an interview for a job somewhere. And I said, I've liberated a whole continent for women. And some old dear stood up and she said, well, who the hell gives a damn? Which I thought was quite meaningful. Yeah. You know, if it had been a worthwhile continent, then fine. But it was just the Antarctic. Anyway. And that was, 1969. And I went on another couple of expeditions after that. I took a party to, Olaf Orheim had been working on Deception Island, and we'd done some good work. He first went in 1969, as I remember. When was the volcanic eruption? 68, I think. And,
Well, there was one in 67, because I was down there when it blew in McMurdo, and we were listening to him on a radio stream for
help.
If I could, by the way, I'd like a copy of that.
I was thinking the transcriptionists
put all this together.
Okay, 71, 72, Supervisor Deception Island Project. Yeah. And that was the last full-scale, full meeting that I had in the Antarctic. Because that year, 72, I became dean at Ohio State. And
dean to the university?
No, dean of the biggest college, which was Math and Physical Sciences, in 1972. And that effectively ruined my career, because I never had the chance to go back to the Antarctic as a working stiff. And after that, I just became an administrator. I was on the...
Were you on the Polar Research Board?
Polar Research Board, National Research Council, Geophysics, Arctic Institute of North America, I was on the Board of Governors, Council of the International Glaciological Society, and U.S. representative to various groups on glaciology or scientific whatever. I was chairman of the SCAR Working Group on Glaciology for 15 years or something silly, from 19... When the heck was it? Until I retired,
1965,
1986.
What, 73 you became
I
dean?
I think it was 72 I became dean.
Okay.
And
you retired?
I retired in 86, beginning of 86. Well, it became a question of, you know, I'd been dean of this monumentally huge college. I'd managed to run... I'd run the college with an office staff of four people, whereas most of the deans had 20 people running the college, and I reckon that most of them were just spinning wheels. So my first job was to sack everybody. We ran our college, and we won half of the total university awards for outstanding teaching and outstanding research, which I was rather pleased with. And I was being solicited for university presidencies and so on. And the more I looked at university presidencies, the less satisfactory a job it seemed to be. You know, I took note of the people I knew who'd been university presidents. To stick with the polar stuff, Larry Gould had been highly successful. Jim had been moderately successful. Rutford had been let's just say he's not been so successful. And the more I looked at the job, the more one-handed it seemed to be. You were either glad-handing politicians or holding your hand out for money. And the more I looked at it, the less I liked it. And in the end, I said to myself, there are many, many other things in life that I wish to do other than run a college, including writing and running a book business and so on. So what I said in the end was, I am going to retire. And by chance, we had just put into place a system that would allow me to retire at the age of 55, 56. And I duly did that, with a very small pension accordingly. And we moved rather shortly after that to Bainbridge Island.
But you've been back to the Antarctic with the tour group many times.
Eight, I think it is now. Something like that, five, eight. And my only reason for doing it was that this offered me an opportunity to take my wife to see some of the places that I'd been to.
You saw my note that I sent out to all the people in the Polar Society. This is your opportunity to take your wife to show them what you've been talking about for 60 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And some guys have taken me up on it, but only a few. Mm-hmm. They all want a lecture, and I said, okay, you got to make your own run to lecture. I can't get you the job. You got to. Here's IATO's number. Get the list of tour companies and start phoning them.
Sorry, what was that name you used?
IATO, the International Association of Antarctic Tour Operators.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they all want to go for free. They don't come. It's up to you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I even put the flyer out, because it's more trouble than it's worth. I thought we'd have a whole shipload.
Yeah.
There must have been 15 people asking me to do it.
Mm-hmm. No, that was...
What do you think of tourists down in the Antarctic?
Oh, absolutely. I'm all in favor.
Do you think they support the environmental concerns of the continent?
Look, I started work in the Antarctic in 1958. And the biggest bunch of polluters in the Antarctic at that time was, one, U.S. Navy. Number two, perhaps the U.S. scientists. I'm excluding the New Zealanders from this, because New Zealanders were always a heck of a sight tidier than the Americans.
Because they're smaller. And they put their garbage in our dump.
Yeah. All right. Now, I'm all in favor of tourists in Antarctica. After all, you are spending U.S. taxpayers' money, and it helps a little to have some aficionados, some enthusiasts, who will support that spending of taxpayers' money. So I'm all in favor. Some of the things that we produce are rather ludicrous, you know, like the Antarctic Protocol on non-indigenous whatevers. All right, so on one of the tour ships that I went on, They had to hide the palm tree that had previously been somewhere prominent because an inspector was coming on board. And this was non-indigenous, and you're not allowed to take that to Antarctica.
Well, they grow stuff in greenhouses for years.
I know that.
And I went to visit the French at the Monteville, and they had parakeets in the middle of a penguin.
Oh, right. Okay. That's good. That's good. I haven't heard that one.
And they had a cat. It was kind of funny. The penguins hadn't been at de Monteville. They moved in after the French came. Adelies. But this cat came out when I'm standing there. It looks like this and goes running for this other building. The door was open.
Yeah.
And these Adelies start chasing it.
That was the...
And they... the cat.
Yeah.
And somebody happened to close the door before the cat gets there. And by then, the Adelies had blocked the escape route to back to the other building. And they started pecking this bugger.
Lovely. Lovely.
And anyway, the French guy I was talking to was the pilot who was drinking wine. I didn't know he was the pilot. He just wanted to flew me back to the Herp Strip. You know, they were on an island. He goes over and picks his poor cat up, you know, and takes him and throws him. You hear the joke about the 500-pound canary going, "Here, kitty, kitty, kitty." That's kind of how it was. The penguins were as big as the cat. Funny, huh?
Anyway,
non-indigenous species. They were a little too late.
Yeah. The point is that there were large numbers of humans who were slightly non-indigenous on the ship, but so on. Now, I'm all
wanted to get rid of the dogs.
Yeah. I'm all in favor of the growth of the tourist industry. All right. Where's its limit? And in one of my lectures on one of the ships, and I can't recall which, I asked folk how they would limit the number of Antarctic visitors. And I got the most heated discussion that I ever had in any lecture. You know, you limit folk by age. So I said, all right, tell me more. Only over 65. All right, only under 65, depending which side of the line you were on. Put the fees up, right? Put the costs up, so that you limit it, obviously, by wealth and so on. Large numbers are worthwhile suggestions. But, no, I'm all in favor of those things.
So you've seen both sides of the tourist thing. You've been seen from the professional side and then from the tourist side, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you seen the tourists misbehave in any of the rookeries?
Not ever. I became policeman on several of the Antarctic things.
I've done on everything.
And, you know, never have we had the slightest trouble. The only bit of scrap that I've ever picked up was one safety pin. And that was on Deception Island. Yeah. My wife found some bits of plastic, which had been thrown away by another tourist. But no, they are very, very good, very, very tidy.
I'm going to switch the subject here. You were at Cambridge. You've seen the growth of Spry. Gordon Roman managed most of that. Have you had much to do with Gordon?
Oh, absolutely. Gordon, when I first knew him, was a junior lecturer, maybe a lecturer, in physics at Birmingham University. And I was a student. And the talk that I remember Gordon giving was before he went down to Sydney Island as the, was it, I can't remember if he was station leader or just one of the scientific staff. But he went to Sydney for a year, I guess, in when? Oh, 1950 perhaps.
Well, he was on the International British Norwegian...
Oh, that's okay. He was a member of the Mordheim people in 1952. Okay, but that was later. That was after the Cygnia episode. Cygnia, I guess, was 19 48, something like that. All right, then he went to Mordheim as third in command. And I knew lots of the Mordheim people. I'd never met John Gerber, but I knew Walter Schutte extremely well. In fact, I invited Walter to come to Ohio State as a visiting whatever, and I went as a visitor to his place, and so on. Then Gordon went to Canberra. He is an Australian. Mm-hmm. He went to Canberra as a something in geophysics. And rather shortly after that, before he got himself established in Canberra, he was invited to come to the Scott Polar as the director. And quite honestly, I was rather surprised that they picked on Gordon at that stage. But he did a first-rate, clinking good job. And when he quit, I dithered with the idea of applying for the job myself. But then when I found out what the salary was and compared it with what I was getting at Ohio State, we just let it die. So I never even bothered to apply.
A lot of people have been bought from England to Ohio State. You did that, I assume. At least you must have started the flow.
Mm-hmm.
Some very top-rate researchers.
Thank you, yes.
The connections, the Bird Polar Research Center, Spry.
Yeah. Spry is certainly the senior research institute in polar matters in the world. I guess so. I can't think of anywhere comparable. Okay, as a research institute, it has had its ups and downs. It had its ups in the 1950s, and then with one or two of the successive directors, it fell by the wayside. And how John Heap is doing now, quite honestly, I don't know.
He's leaving, or left, I think.
Has he left?
He's
right, retired. He's left. Yeah. He left, and Scott Polar is no longer an independent entity. It's now part of the geography department, and I think that this is a backward step if ever I've seen one. Because it won't save money, and it does lose them an awful lot of prestige. And Gordon must be quite hurting that it's lost its independence.
Yeah, it's a shame.
Yeah.
How about the Bird Polar Research Center? How do you feel about its development?
Oh, it's Dick Goldthwaite was the first director. I was the second director, and Dick worked awfully hard, and I worked awfully hard in two regards. Number one was picking up Dick Goldthwaite's bits and pieces. And secondly, in trying to develop the staff and our access to money. And it was all very highly successful, I thought. We got some good people. I mentioned Kay Everett and John Mercer and David Elliott and several others as well. All right, then my successor was Rudy, Emmanuel Rudolph. Rudy was a laid-back sort of person. He coasted rather a lot. Then David Elliott came along, and David stayed too long as director, but he was very effective, especially in his first years. David was very, very good. But I'd seen what happened to several other comparable institutes, particularly the Arctic.
Arctic Institute?
Arctic and Alpine Research, what the heck does it call itself, Boulder?
Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research?
Yeah, INSTAR, that's it.
INSTAR.
All right, INSTAR had a director who shall remain nameless, or I can name him. He stayed on too long as director, and the place went rapidly downhill. But eventually they got themselves back together again, and so David stayed, I thought, just a little bit too long as director. But Most of that was because it was very difficult to find a replacement. Okay, and who came along? Ken Jezik eventually came along. I'd known Ken when he was a graduate student with Charlie Bentley at Madison, Wisconsin. And Ken, I think, did a good job, though I'd sort of lost a lot of day-to-day contact with the Institute at that stage. And I really don't know Lyons at all, the current director, recently appointed. But he's certainly got a good scientific reputation.
Yeah. Good point. He's speaking at the symposium.
Mm-hmm.
You claim to have found Ken Jezik?
No, I didn't.
The reason, I've got an interesting story to tell on it. I'm interviewing Martin Pomerantz, of course, is cosmic ray, South Pole, astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we started an awful lot of guys through his programs into polar research.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, one of them that will really surprise you is Ken Jezik.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell do you have to do with you? He says, he was a guy we had winter over. He's an employee. We taught him to manage the cosmic ray building at McMurdo, and that's what he did, and that was his introduction to the Antarctic. And he noticed around, saw the other work going, changed his life. He went off and got his doctorate. But he got started with me.
With Martin.
Yes.
Oh, great. No, I didn't, and I make no claims to Ken. I had met him when he was at Madison, but that was all.
So tell me now, we may have covered it before, but I want to make sure. You were there about the time IGY was pumping, or the results of IGY was to start permanent programs, basically.
Oh, absolutely.
They didn't
yes.
expect that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Van Allen told me he didn't expect that.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have a third polar year and be good. The key to getting your grant money at first was through NSF, Mark Turner, or any other specific individual?
Well, it depends on the nature of the program as to who would be the program manager to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But Mort for the glaciology and for the geology, which
mm-hmm.
was most of my personal interest, and a large part of the total interest of the Institute of Polar Studies.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We had, after the Institute had been going for many years, and David Elliott was director, the opportunity came of acquiring Bird's archives, the archival material from Richard E. Bird. And it was an interesting way of going about disposing of the stuff. They had fixed a price for the archives, $250,000. All right, and it was to be an open academic type of competition amongst the various universities who were interested in acquiring it. Okay. Dick Goldthwaite and Larry Gould and I and one or two others, including Pete Anderson, had a deal to do with this. We wrote the proposal to the Bird Family Trust, or whatever it called itself, and the people who were, and in this we have to say what we would do with the archives.
Which year was this? Were you still at the... Were you dean then?
I think that was my first year as dean. I think that was 1972. I think that was it. All right, and we made the usual kind of remarks. We will change the name of our Institute of Polar Studies to the Bird Polar Research Center. Okay, no problem with that. Except some of us had a rather lesser regard for Bird as a person than others did. And so on. But, you know, Bird certainly established a U.S. place in Bird polar history, Antarctic exploration, and so on. Definitely.
He created a lot of careers.
Oh, absolutely. Sure, absolutely. All right. And what would we do with the archives? All right. Number one, we will set up an archive, a proper archive. Number two, we'll change the name of the institute from Institute of Polar Studies to Bird Polar. We will make a small brass plate and put it on the building behind some fast-growing evergreens, and so on. That's just a little joke, I hope. David, I thought, was a little bit delicate. The pressure of space in Mendenhall was becoming excessive, and we could not, against the geology department, we, the Institute or Bird Polar Center, could not get more space. Right. But we were offered some prime space over on West Campus, and since we had rather little to do with the rest of campus, that was just fine by me, and I reckon David should have grabbed the best space when it first became available. But we put it off for a year or two, by which times the best space had gone, but I still like the quarters that they have over on West Campus. They're fine.
Yeah, I changed the name from Scott Hall to Bird Hall.
No, it's still Scott Hall. But
yeah.
And I can't remember
Different
who was
Scott. Yeah.
I can't remember who was Scott. Do you happen to know?
Well, it's some.
I presume he was some Ohio legislator or what have you.
I asked. Nobody knew.
No. I can find out. If it's of any importance, I can't imagine it is. No. We've had some good people in the institute, some really good, first-rate people. I don't mean just the researchers, but Lynn Lay is a jolly good librarian. When she first came, she was very much a junior, and she has grown immensely.
They use her too much as a gopher and don't let her librarian.
Yeah, I know that. Well, as ever, we're short of low-level support, very short. And Lynn Everett has done pretty well for herself too. We had a very, very good executive secretary, Ray.
She just retired.
Yeah, who's just retired. And I don't know if they've managed to find an adequate replacement.
Lynn Everett.
Lynn Everett?
She's pretty much doing it, yeah. She sits in the office and mm-hmm. she's not supposed to, but apparently they grab her.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay.
She's managing the funds for our grant. Yeah, you know, she mm-hmm. pays it out to us.
And we'll do it very well.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
Well, so you've seen the development of this from the very beginning, basically.
Yeah, well, Goldthwaite invited me to come along to help set it up.
Mm-hmm.
I was very, very happy to come. And I'm not the least bit sorry in the long term that we came to such a dismal place as Columbus, Ohio. All right, but when it became a question of retiring, as I say, I decided not to become a university president. I did not wish to return to the department because the folk there included Ian and Lonnie, were a heck of a sight brighter than I was and were doing some first-rate work, and one never wants to compete with one's own graduate students. Alright, so we decided to retire. We came here. Alright, we came here because Jill said, you know, I don't mind living in Columbus, Ohio, but I'm damned to want to die here. And I had been a visiting we did it a long time, about where to retire to. Shall we go back to Britain? Shall we go to Australia, New Zealand, Canada? But in the end, all of our material assets, that is three children, all lived in the United States, and they weren't going to move as far as we could see. So we're going to stay here. All right. Where in the United States would you live? That's fine.
Well,
and that's enough.
15 times as a scientist and
I really
eight times as a lecturer, huh?
Something like that.
That's pretty good.
But that's enough, because there are so many parts of the world that I would like to see that I haven't seen, that I have a doubt now that I shall ever go back to the Antarctic.
Anyway, you made your decision, you were making your decision to...
Where do we retire? All right, which country? And we're forced by our health insurance to be in the US. We're not absolutely bound here, but it's a hell of a sight more convenient.
That's Ohio State?
Yeah, with Ohio State's whatever. Our children are here, so we're going to stay here. All right, it so happens that our children live further away in this country than if we'd stayed in Columbus and they'd moved to Britain. Because we have a son who works in Washington, D.C. with the U.S. Treasury. We have a daughter who is in Madison, Wisconsin. And we have a son who lives on the island, but he soon won't live on the island. So we're very scattered.
A lot of grandkids?
And we have four grandchildren, yes. Two in Washington, D.C., and two in Madison, Wisconsin. But we see them too infrequently. And the only advantage, as far as I could see, of becoming a grandparent was that you have grandchildren. And you can see them and enjoy their growing up. That's all right, but that's okay.
Well, I think this has been a good interview. Is there anything that you regret?
What do I regret?
Would you do different? Possibly.
My God, this what if game is highly unproductive. I'd taken the job in London? I would have been by now, assuming that I'd been fairly bright, which I thought I was at the time, I would have, unindustrious, I would have been a sir by now. In all probability, I'd certainly be an FRS and so on. As it is, all I am is just an FRSA, Fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. And this, I think, was a reward for my part in international education. But certainly not for my work as an artist, certainly not for my work as a scientist.
That raises a point. You developed teaching programs. You mentioned it at the University of Ohio State.
Yeah. We had... I developed a glaciology program. I'm not going to comment on the academic qualities of that program. I thought it was rather good, but I certainly produced some good glaciologists out of it, like the ones I mentioned.
Was it a graduate teaching program?
It was entirely graduate. I had never had an undergraduate. In fact, that's why I became chairman. Because if I hadn't become chairman of the geology department, they were going to make me teach a Geology 100 course, which would have been frightening, wouldn't it?
Yes.
No, I'd never taken any courses in geology when I became chairman of the geology department, but because they couldn't think of anything else for me to do.
You're familiar with certainly the way that the British system produces their doctorates as compared to sort of the American system, which requires many more courses.
Yes.
Mandatory. Which is best?
I imported a large number of British or British style, which includes Australia and New Zealand, bachelor's people. And they were better prepared than were the American undergraduates. They could think better, and so on. But by the time you get through a PhD, there's not anything to choose other than the ability of the person. So that the British PhD will have a much narrower field of training, but he will have a better ability to think. And obviously, one shouldn't make any broad statement like that.
It's still individual.
Yeah.
Well, I had the same observation after a year at Scott Cohen. They produce some pretty sharp guys. The trouble is, they don't produce as many. I'm not A form, B form,
Yeah, yeah.
It's not the best way to go, as far as I'm concerned. You don't have any late bloomers. It's hard to make a late bloomer.
Yes.
The United States is kind of famous for late bloomers.
Yes.
Some people get their act together late in life.
Mm-hmm.
My son's one of them. He got his degree at 32.
Mm-hmm.
Quite well. Well, that's interesting because you've seen it from both sides.
Mm-hmm.
You still retain your British citizenship?
No. One of the reasons, well, I bring this up just largely for fun, one of the reasons that I'm an American citizen is Larry Gould. I became the U.S. representative on SCAR. Initially on the SCAR Committee on Glaciology. And Larry said to me one day, "You are an American citizen, aren't you?" And I said, "No." He said, "How come you are the U.S. representative on this international body?" All right, that wasn't the only reason that I became a U.S. citizen. At that time, I'd got some pretensions to becoming a university president. And it's rather more difficult as a non-American to become a president of an American university. All right, so for that and a dozen other absolutely trivial reasons, I became a U.S. citizen when? Somewhere in the late 70s.
Been over here for a while.
Yeah, we came in 1961, so that's well nigh 40 years now.
My wife got to be, it took her 32 years. I said, "You don't have to do it. In fact, you're going to lose your Dutch Social Security."
Oh, does she get Dutch? Okay,
She would get free nursing home care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that type
of... No, the... There's a very big monetary disadvantage to not being a U.S. citizen.
There is?
Very definitely. Assuming you're going to die, and while that isn't my ambition, it's moderately inevitable. All right, if I die as a British citizen, I do not get this 625,000, is that the number? Dollar allowance, if that's what you could call it.
Estate
allowance.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. All right, so it really makes quite a bit of difference. So with a wife as well, if we could ever reach the stage of having $1.2 million, which seems highly unlikely, but still, you're looking at estate taxes. I don't know what they are. What are they? Estate taxes. On $1 million. Anyway, that's what we're saving
39.
By becoming a...
Pretty sure it's 39%.
Is it? I don't know what it is. But, we're never going to reach the stage.
Plus state retirement tax.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's the only reason that I became a U.S. citizen. My wife had come... excuse me. A rather different reason for becoming a U.S. citizen. We lived on the island and we did not like the mayor. So she became a US citizen so she could vote for her choice of mayor. Or something. Okay.
I think we're done.